we have a very, very special episode. It's a collaboration with the Greenshaw Learning Trust Book Club. We had an episode last year. It's taken one whole year to do this episode. It's been one year in the making. And MatChat Live is an organic experience, visceral, responsive thing. So it's live, and it's on Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, and YouTube. So wherever you tuned in from, if you have any thoughts, just reply with a comment. You'll have to be logged into those things, and we'll have a look, and we'll put the question to the panel. So it's driven by you. You can even change the direction of the whole conversation, just like responsive teaching. So yeah, we'll do a very quick round of introductions, and we'll get cracking. So I'm Atul. I'm an online tutor. I teach maths all over the world, really, from year 1 to year 13. I also host Math Chat Live. Over to you, Dave. Yeah.
Thanks, Atul. I'm Dave. I'm a lead practitioner in a school in Bristol. I've teached about 20 years, and just can't wait to get stuck into this.
And Rhiannon.
Hi, Rhiannon Rainbow. I work in the same trust that Dave does, but I work across all of our secondary schools, so it's a very privileged position to be in, focusing on maths and, of course, running the book club with Dave and getting these great opportunities as well. So thank you once again for this.
It's all about the book club and books. And finally, over to you, Sunil.
Thank you so much. I'm horrible at introductions because I always forget some key things. But my name is Sunil Singh. I'm the author of Chasing Rabbits and two other books, Math Recess and Pie of Life, which was my first book. And all these three books were written after I left education. I was a math, physics, and occasionally English teacher for 19 years. Up until 2013, and I left the system for many reasons, but I think that the one which was the most important was that I was dissatisfied with the way that students were learning mathematics and the culture and the atmosphere around it. It wasn't a safe and caring environment. I didn't know what I was going to do, but I knew I didn't want to do that anymore. And then, you know, three books later, and I also work as an advisor at Amplify, which is an American company based in Brooklyn, New York, and I help bake and curate in the storytelling narrative, which, you know, obviously was a part of Chasing Rabbits, into their K-12 platform. So storytelling, the idea of math history and narrative, has become even more pronounced, definitely over here in North America. And if I could just add one more thing, because I had a meeting recently, I'm on the board of directors of the Human Restoration Project, which is a nonprofit organization which looks at humanizing education. And so very excited about the work I do there in terms of, again, humanizing education, but also humanizing mathematics. So it's right in my sweet spot of the things I'm doing right now in 2022.
That's a fantastic introduction. And we've been talking in the green room, or as I call the backstage area. We are in for a absolute cracker, organic, deep, philosophical, big picture stuff that I absolutely love, and I'm sure you love it out there as well. So I'll hand over to Rhi and Dave as a standard book club episode. Do take it from there. Do what you must. Yeah.
Oh, thank you so much. I always love these ones where we join up with you as well, and you help us to be that 10% braver at all to live stream it and give us your support as well, and to be able to be joined by yourself too, Sunil. I mean, as you mentioned there, just off as you were thinking about it, some of the things that you've done and that depth of awareness, thought, understanding, and when we were in the green room, some of the really deep philosophical thinking that came out almost straight away. It was, I think we're going to be in for an absolute treat this evening, not just from the joys that I've had dipping into your book. And it's a sheer pleasure to be reading that when I'm working through it myself. So you've done an incredibly impressive introduction already. So what I suppose what it is for me to do is say that this is actually our 47th session. Wow. It's brilliant. 47 is a pretty nice number. I think it's a prime number.
Yeah,
go with that one. Yep. I'll go with that one. So it's a really, really good one to be having this evening. And of course, it's our second one where we've linked up with you as well, Atul. So that's another special prime number. But what I'll do now then is I'll hand over to Dave, because it goes without saying why we would be discussing your book this evening. But Dave will help to just give a little bit more depth and thinking around that for other people, so they can hear how it links with some of the other work that we've done, and also why this specific section that we're focusing on as well, which was a pretty difficult choice, if I remember rightly, Dave, trying to choose the section for today. So I'll hand over to Dave, and then we'll be passing back to you, if that's okay, Sunil, because we just really want to hear as much from you as possible tonight. So absolutely. Over to you, Dave.
And thanks so much, Sunil, for giving us your time tonight. It's just such a pleasure to be able to talk with you about the book. And straight away, I've got a takeaway for the book, which is around living in quadrant two. And there's a graph that talks about things being important but not urgent, and some of the other things that might fall into that category as well, like building relationships. But that's become a little bit of a sort of mindfulness for me. I'm somebody who's quite an anxious person generally, and everything feels really urgent. And I enjoy maths, but I get worried about failure, and I get worried about what other people might think, not getting it right. And it's just sort of helped me to really reframe the way I think about the subject that I love. And that for me was a real sort of clincher for wanting to explore a lot deeper some of the messages in the book. Just that meaning without anxiety that you can get, and then you succeed more often. You have that sort of greater level of success with the mathematics you're doing, because you're curious, you're trying things that maybe you wouldn't try before, and you can link with other people, you can link ideas together, and all these ideas are in the book, of course. But it made me think then about how I could pass this on to the students that I teach and support that maths anxiety, and what I could do in the classroom to support that. And at the moment, the book, what it's done for me is it's almost sort of reframed my mathematical personality in the classroom. It's made me think in a different way. So rather than going, I'm going to try this thing, I'm going to try that thing, it's almost like a different approach to the students, to the subjects I teach. And I just think that is real sort of plus from the book for me, that's really helped my progress in my mathematics teaching. So it sort of gives you a little idea of sort of why we've chosen it. I think the way the book's written, the narrative is just gripping, and you can really immerse yourself in this sort of way of thinking, but really enjoy the mathematics that's in there as well. And just the little quotes that you have throughout the book are just sort of grip me. The idea, I forget the quote now, but it's something along the lines of one person saying, "What if I fail?" and the other person saying, "What if you fly?" And it's those sort of little quotes that go through that just as I'm reading, I just go, oh yeah, that all makes sense. That's the way I need to be thinking about this. And so I guess for me, what I'm looking forward to getting from this session and Rihanna likewise is to find out how we can support our students with any maths anxiety, how we can sort of build the love for mathematics. Because there's another quote in there, I think, that says something like maths, students don't find maths hard, they find it boring, I think. And so how we can make it more interesting for them as well. But Sunil, I'm just going to hand over to you to talk, because I think we just need to listen to you, really. I can't wait to hear about your thoughts about the book.
Well, you said something very interesting, Dave. Thank you so much. About reframing your personality. And that is actually, I would say, a pretty important idea, at least implicitly, that was sort of through the book, is that before we can change the mindset and attitude of our students, we have to change ours organically. And that's a key word, organically. It shouldn't be ham-fisted. It shouldn't be a thou shalt. It shouldn't be something which... some sort of directive or initiative, because it's the flavor of the month. It has to occur organically. And when you talked about reforming your personality, I'll be even more specific, because you said some words which sort of fell from you were talking, love for mathematics. One of the things which I did not directly quote in the book, but was definitely on my mind, was the work of Alfred North Whitehead, mathematician and philosopher, English mathematician philosopher, who wrote the book Aims of Education in 1929, but his ideas for probably before that. And one of the things that we unfortunately don't do very well is to look at our past, because we think everything in the past must be archaic or anachronistic and has no use to us going forward. In fact, many ideas of even 100 years ago were just never implemented and were ahead of their time. So one of the things Alfred North Whitehead had talked about was the rhythm of learning, the three stages of learning for any subject. And I'll just reveal them backwards. It's some sort of cryptic sort of story. The last stage is generalization. We want in adulthood, and we want kids to generalize whatever they've learned to apply into real life conversations and interactions and social things like that. And the stage before it is precision, which occurs in youth. Now, with mathematics, we definitely want that precision component there for kids to be very mindful in terms of their arithmetic and algebra, and to have a deep understanding of every single step they take and why they've taken it. The first stage is romance, though. And what we've done, unfortunately, everywhere, we've doubled down on precision and put it into elementary. And what has resulted is just a house of cards now of learning. That's why it all falls apart, because we didn't ever install formally that stage of romance, which is just about awe, curiosity, and wonder, which is completely in line with what childhood is. Childhood is this amazing, imaginative, fantastical state of being. And you don't rush the precision. It will come. They will ask the questions about precision. But romance, if you skip it, then everything else is going to fall apart. And as we have to, and so if that's the first stage, then the first responsibility of teachers in that stage is to romance the students with mathematics. But then the stage before that, going full circle to what you said about, perhaps reforming one's personality, is we have to be seduced by mathematics. If we've never been seduced by, like, one of the things I ask teachers, and your answer is honest, I go, why do you teach mathematics? Is it your job responsibility? Is it, like, whatever it is, it's the honest answer. But I want to know why it is. And I'm not sure if especially go further down into the elementary panel, it's because they love mathematics. And you don't have to be good at mathematics. Like, that's the other thing, too, that a lot of people think that, oh, if you love something, you must be good at it. That's not true at all. I love music. My next book is about music, but I can't play a musical instrument. My singing stopped in seventh grade when I was like 12 years old. I mean, I was in the choir. So this book was also like, okay, here's how I sort of fell in love with mathematics. And I also purposely included my own story. And sometimes I went like, the narrative drifted from the math, but I did it on purpose, because for me to illuminate mathematics means it needs the spotlight to be on other things. Like, mathematics is a part of our life. It's embedded in me. I like it like I was, I like soccer, football, or music, or cooking, my kids, everything. It's intertwined in me. It's not a game face I put on from 9 to 3 when I was teaching and then come home and don't think about math. I don't even have to do a math problem to think about mathematics. And that goes to also one of the things I wanted to mention that I think is very important as teachers. Like, one of the things you can actually do in the classroom, and it's the easiest thing you can do. Easy in terms of the math, but maybe not easy in terms of vulnerability, is do a math problem for the first time in front of kids. When do we show our mathematical thinking? We don't. We do it in the math office. We do it at home. We do it in the car ride. And so when we present our solutions to students, it just comes automatically. It comes too quickly. We already have the 3-4 different strategies available to us. I don't think that's very honest, because that's not how mathematics works. How mathematics works is like, okay, here's a problem. I have no idea what to do. I'm stuck. And that's been the historic development of mathematics. And I only did that in my latter half of I'd say the last 3 years of my career. The first year of teaching, I actually was teaching a calculus class in my first year, and I only assigned the problems that I could do. So I made sure, okay, Sunil can do number 8, 9, 14A. Okay, those are the ones I'm going to assign because I know how to do them. By the end, and that's the other ironic thing, is like it took me 10 times before I finally go, okay, I think I understand calculus. I understand calculus to put my own spin on it, to tell my own story of it. And I would assign all the questions or just, okay, here. And I knew that there'd be a couple of questions that kids would ask that they couldn't do. And I would do them for the first time in front of them. And sometimes I got halfway through, but it was my real time struggle. And I wasn't faking it. I'm not sure. I mean, did we set up the right function here? Are we missing something? Like, I'm talking out loud. And that only got the kids more interested in mathematics because of that. So the book is a real story of how I see mathematics and just would like it to exist in our society because and I guess anyone who is watching and, loves mathematics, maths. I have to get used to that. I think we say pluralizing math to be maths is correct as opposed to saying math, because you don't say mathematic, right? That's just an aside for me. But we're blessed to see the world through a mathematical lens. Like we're so lucky. Like, why do you think most of us smile all the time, right? And then the goal then is to have that be equitable and accessible to all students and not to partition them in certain streams. And these students are going to do, like, I think in the British, the A levels or things, whatever. We have every part of the world has stratified systems. And that's stratified because we never gave all the kids the same opportunity to fall in love with mathematics. Right. It's really the first stage went missing. It went completely like off the rails. So, I don't know if there's anything you want to add in at this time and just sort of surf and riff off of my own kind of just opening, but I'd love to hear just any comments that you might have right now.
Well, I got one comment about my own planning, just very quickly, where if I've not planned very well, I have done a lot of that modelling in front of them, maybe not deliberately. So I can empathise with that. But no, I really like that idea of going through that healthy struggle with the students and showing them that it's all about, I think there's an analogy in the book about being in the dark and looking around and feeling the furniture, and all of a sudden the lights go on when you get the links and you can see how it all fits together. And I think there's really something in that of being with the students, talking about sort of what's not quite working and why that might not quite be working and narrating that with them. I think there's huge value in that.
The that's the other thing too, is that the intrinsic curiosity for numbers and pattern making we're all born with it. We're all born for, like, I mean, the universe is made of mathematics everywhere, right? And I didn't put this in the book, but so my stage of romance, and I'm writing an article for NCTM, which stands for the National Council of Teachers of Mathematics, which is the largest math organization in North America. And I'm writing an article for them about romance, very short article, but most of it's about my official stage of romance. I didn't even really recognize it. Was when I was 8 years old and we had moved to Canada in 1970. And I was born in Australia, Hobart, Tasmania. And in 1972, we moved into our first house, a semi-detached house, just north of Toronto, here in the province of Ontario. And, with a house you move into, there's always some things which are intentionally or unintentionally left behind. And in what would be my future bedroom, it's almost like now looking back, like it almost seems too unbelievable a story to be true. There was only one thing left in my bedroom, and that was in the closet. And it was a math book that said 12 mathematics, which meant it was 12th grade. So 12th grade is our final grade in high school. And I'd be going into third grade. Now, I could read. And I remember picking up the book, and I love the smell of old books, that musty smell. It's got that sort of scent of wisdom, and just I love that smell. And I remember going through the book, and I could read it all. And I knew it was a math book, and I knew 12 stood for 12th grade. But I understood none of it, obviously, right? I understood none of it. All the brackets, all the, you know, parentheses, and f at x, g at x, and none of it made sense to me. And I remember coming across the word log, and I go, oh, I know what log is. Like, you know, it's like a stump you sit on, but it's obviously not the same log, because I would see this log in front of all these numbers I recognized. And it produced a result which didn't make sense to me at all. So none of it made sense to me, but I remember going, not like, oh, I'm gonna know this as quickly as possible. I'm gonna spend my summers and I'm gonna figure it out. I had the sense to go, you know what, one day, about 9 years from now, I will understand this. So I was in romance. I had no interest in precision. And that's really in a very casual way is what romance looks like. Right? That's what it looks like. It's almost Shakespearean, the tragedy. If you want to get to where you want students to be in mathematics, it's almost the fable, the tortoise and the hare. You know, be the tortoise. So I there's other things which happened too, but 1977. The Guinness World Book of Records. I love that book, and I got one for Christmas, that one, 1977. Still have it somewhere here. And all the records are fascinating, but I was fascinated by this numbers record, the largest number ever used in a math problem, which was Graham's number. And again, I could read, but I was going, and there was all this arrow notation, which was Knuth's arrow, and which of course I didn't know. And again, I didn't understand Graham's. I still don't understand Graham's number. It's very, I get it a little bit, but it'll make your head implode like a black hole. I think as some of the number file guys pointed out, they got a couple of videos on the Graham's number. But it was just the lore of large numbers, right? Like, I think that's another way to grab kids early on, is to get them to think about numbers like how big they are, and you know, like the size, like, you know, how many grains of sand are there in Earth, or how many drops, how many atoms, hydrogen atoms are there in a, you know, water molecule, you know, the size of the universe. Like, that's what got me, like, that we could measure largeness, and even like the Mersenne prime, I think the 51st Mersenne prime was found 2021, and I forget the exponent, but I think it was 77 million or something like that, to the exponent 77 or 81 million. And what I love about, because my daughter was into primes back then, was that even if your calculator had the physical space and you kept going 2 times 2 times 2 times 2, I did the math. I go, it would take you 8 months for you to finish that calculation by going 2 times 2 times 2 times 2. And, you know, here you have another prime number way out there. And that still fascinates me. So the same things I'm fascinated by that I was fascinated in childhood still fascinate me today. And that's what I think Alfred North Whitehead was talking about, that those stages don't disappear. They add on. So at generalization, it comes full circle to romance again, that romance, precision are part of generalization, and they all sort of marry together. And I'm 58 years old, and you know, I think of mathematics through the lens of a child, and sometimes I think of it like in a general aspect of how math can help society. And then, of course, in the book, I can talk about precision, like very specific parts, like in chapter 8, I believe, where I present all these different math problems by looking at them through different sort of lens. You know, that line by line sort of idea about mathematics. It kind of blows me away that, you know, like, I know this for some, it might seem kind of like, okay, silly, but because I taught calculus, I can locate the tangent on a lemniscate. And I smile at that because that shape, you could show a five-year-old, which I think means ribbon in Latin or Greek, I forget. And you could actually explain to them what a horizontal, they know what horizontal, a vertical and horizontal lines are. And then you could place a horizontal line as a tangent. You could explain tangent just to, means to touch at one point. And they would see, oh, I see those are tangent lines. Oh, that's not a tangent. So they would understand what tangent is. And yes, these kids in 5, 6-year-olds could locate a horizontal tangent on the lemniscate. And they'd be pretty close to exactly where that horizontal tangent is. But the beautiful part is you need about 10 years of mathematics before you can actually locate the exact point. And that sort of small shift of where that's pretty much where the horizontal tangent is and the exact place it is, it's minuscule in terms of the actual distance, the delta between the points. But in that tiny delta lies the entire curriculum of mathematics to be able to do it. I've thought about that many a times, that I got lucky and I can do it. And even if you can, after you take the derivative of that particular function, the algebra, which is 70% of solving those optimization problems or points or problems like that, locating tangents, it's algebra. And the fact that I learned and understood, I made mistakes in terms of mistakes you would make doing algebra. That's fine. And I still make mistakes doing algebra. But what the difference is, every step that I do in algebra, I understand why I do it. I understand my intentions. And I'm very aware of that. And that didn't, you know, I didn't acquire that one day. That was over a period of time. And, you know, that same book I looked at as a third, when I was in third grade, 8 years old, now that book I can read, like, of course I understand it all. So it's quite the journey to understand mathematics, and then the journey to appreciate those moments of it. Because if it was just about the answer, I don't think I'm writing books and we're not talking about, like, you know, unless the answer is zero, indeterminate, undefined, infinity, or a specific number related to the problem, I'm not interested in the answer. The two lines, when people ask, like, when I was teaching systems, and, you know, kids are solving systems and they get the answer wrong, and they come to the teacher, they come to me saying, you know, Mr. Singh, can you see what I'm doing wrong? And I would see, and I would look at them, go, they're doing nothing wrong. You've made an arithmetic mistake somewhere, and that's why you're not getting the answer in the back of the book. And my job is not to be your editor. I'm not going to waste my time, because you already know how to do it. If you want to find out where you made a mistake, then go for it. But that's not my job to find your mistake. My job is to make sure that you're on the right path. You're understanding mathematics. You understand the math. But guess what? You, like me, and I will continue this, you've made a mistake at some line. And I will make those mistakes. I will never stop making those mistakes. So that's why we're not going to spend a lot of time talking about it. So yeah, maybe now is a nice time for anyone else to chime in, or if there's any sort of questions.
Yeah, that's it's really interesting to hear other people talk about their journey with mathematics as well. And I think all too often there's this pressure for an answer and for it to be right, especially I think as you mentioned, Sunil, that maybe all too often what we show our students is something that's rehearsed and practiced and step by step. So there's the expectation put upon them that's implied that they Absolutely. Need to be able to look at a problem and know the exact pathway to follow. And so I felt that maybe I was, I don't know, doing something a little bit wrong. I wouldn't tell people so openly about what I would do. Because with my classes, I would intentionally not prepare some of my harder questions. And so that they would see what it's like for somebody with a larger toolbox than them in mathematics,
yeah.
what it might be like when I'm trying something, I'm having a go, I'm going one pathway, what the decisions might be that I'd make and how I'd reflect on it and how I'd step back or how I'd try a different route. I'd go left instead of right. And sometimes I remember a few times, even just with the 15, 16 year olds that I'm teaching, I might look at a question and say, do you know what, this has gone in a really interesting direction. So what I'm going to do with this one is I'm going to take it away, have a look at it separately and bring it back tomorrow, because sometimes it just gets a bit too big. If you have something that diverges instead of converges, it can run away with itself a bit more. But I used to do that. And then I remember our very first session with Mark McCourt, and we were asking him about problem solving and how can we help students to become better problem solvers. And he said, articulate your thinking to them, model it for them, show them what it's like, let them hear your thinking processes, because that will help them to be able to make those decisions and know what it's like at the same time. And I felt that then just, I know it sounds daft, I felt I then had permission for this approach that I was using. But I think the more mathematicians I speak to about it, because I think for a little while I stopped doing maths for fun. I was only doing it for work. I'd lost the romance. But the more I speak to other people who love maths, the more they do that as well. And they take those little risks. And I think I've also taken the pressure off finding the answer. So when I pick up like a maths problem in a book or a maths journal or something, and I'll look at it, I'll go, oh, that's really interesting. And I'll get stuck in and I'll spend a bit of time on it, but I'm not actually interested in finishing it. I'm just interested in getting stuck in and having a go and seeing how I can begin with it and the initial patterns I can locate and the fun side of it. I don't want to finish it.
No, it reminds me of a story of Peter Harrison, who obviously is mentioned a lot in the book. He's the first person I sort of acknowledge and turn. And we're, you know, part of my journey is luck, because without the mentorship of Peter, who, even though he came to Canada from England at the age of 10, he still has his accent, and he's in his, I think he's late 60s now. But Peter, I mean, he's just one of the remarkable people I've met. We still have a great friendship. We have to go for a curry soon. It's been too long, over a year and a half. But one of the things he used to do, he used to assign these really hard problem sets to his students, really hard. We used to tell the students, guess what? You can get help from anybody you want. It just can't be me. So you can ask other teachers in the school. You can go outside the school. You can ask, the parents, if they've got that background, siblings. If you got the initiative, you can ask, college professors or anybody. The only rule was you just couldn't ask them for help. Now, what do you think Peter's end game was for doing that? What did it wasn't he didn't care about the answers on this problem set. What he was interested in was extending the radius of mathematical conversation outside of school. Like, that's genius. He didn't care if kids came back with perfect problem sets or, like, it wasn't worth a lot. But he did this to continue a conversation about mathematics that, well, you know, left the school building on its own. And even when we were doing our final summation, the 1,000-hour exam, which we gave kids, you know, the 12 problems, and 5 will be on the final exam 6 weeks from now, that was some of the best class time I've ever seen, because the kids would be excited to come to class after lunch. They were lining up even like before class started, because they knew that day they got to work on these problems, like, with each other. And there'd be like kids at the board, and there'd be kids sitting in groups, there'd be kids sitting like isolation because working on their own. That's what mathematics looks like. Like, it's not just a solitary thing. It's not always group work. It's not always this. It's a whole bunch of things. And it was, and for Peter and myself, those conversations were the best part about the mathematics. The student discourse about the problem, the back and forth, the kind of the humming and hawing, the erasing of the board, the, you know, the race. Anytime I saw erasing, that was the best part. I love seeing erasing, because that means they're starting from scratch again. My son was making crepes this morning for the first time. I make crepes. I still make. It's one of those things you got to flip at the right time and all that. And he's making it the first time. I go, Aiden, before you start, because he had to videotape it for his class, food nutrition class. I go, let's just do a couple of practice ones first. And he goes, well, I know how to do it. He goes, I know. Just let's. I go, you know how you're going to be a good cook one day? That you made a lot of mistakes. Like, I hope you mess. Don't get me wrong. I want you to do well in this assignment, but part of me hopes you really mess up these crepes. And he didn't. They were actually really good the first time. Unfortunately, as you mentioned, like, we present a model which is like, as soon as kids get a problem, they have to have, like, within certain time frame, I better have an idea ready, or I guess I'm not good at math, right? But no, I mean, if you're stuck, and the longer you're stuck and stick to being stuck, you are actually, that is demonstrating that mathematical resilience. That, okay, there's no progress. Are we still at it? Yeah. I don't know, something's not making sense to me. And you're just going, okay, wow, 15 minutes, 20 minutes. That's so good, right? Like, that's, your mathematical maturity will catch up, trust me. But the part which will be hard, the habit which will be hard to form later, is that sort of patience for irresolution. That's not gonna, you won't be able to buy that anywhere later, right? I've seen it. I've seen a lot of good students become average students because they were really fast in the beginning, and that was, they thought that was a good thing. And but then when mathematics became more complicated, they got frustrated by the fact that their speed was slowing down because they put too much stock into it.
I think just listening to that, it's really interesting for me, sort of where that math anxiety kicks in, this idea of sort of not wanting to fail and not having that same patience sometimes. And I'm making a comparison in my mind with a sort of sporting scenario where I have my little boy, and he'll play sports, and he's very happy to win some and lose some in his sports. However, when it comes to a math problem, so he's 6, but it comes to that math problem, he has this sort of fear almost of not wanting to get it wrong, and the eraser is his enemy. And I'm the same as you. I really like the point where we erase it because we've learned something. We erase it, and it's all very low stakes. It's important, but it's not urgent, and we can just come back to it another time. But for him, it's really important and immediate. However, in a sports environment, it's very different, and failure is sort of embraced. And I'm just really interested into sort of at such a year, early age where I can sort of support that, or with the students I'm teaching, what we can do. There's been a comment in the Twitter about organic teaching as well, and how we can sort of maybe we could elaborate a little bit on what organic teaching looks like and how we can start to foster this this passion, this romance, and this patience, as you say, the habits of patience.
Well, I think the because of a confluence of a lot of things. I mean, pandemic and just the way that we've taught mathematics or education in general. A lot of the things that we do are just out of date. I mean, we went through a period where we had analog teachers teaching digital teens. I mean, teenagers learn differently. A lot of them are learning not because of education, but in spite of it. And so the curiosity factor to me is the most important thing to engender early on. And organic teaching, for me, you have to look at the long, long game. Like, you understand that this is not like, you're not looking for instantaneous success. And the one thing which I think is that when your students come to your classroom, did they leave a little bit more curious? That's it. Because I bet you if you had yes to that every day, or they said yes to that every day in a maths class for their entire career, all that mathematical content knowledge would be there. It would. We have this fear that we have to teach kids, like, you know, for example, like, you know, let's say a three-digit addition by a certain age. Do you not think for one second that a child would ask how to do that question? Like, we've taken, they become passive learners. Kids are super curious. Like, okay, they know how to do 4 + 6 and all that, and they can start to do numbers like, you know, 8 + 7, but now they can't use their hands anymore. And just an aside to that, one of the ways I think is a really organic way of introducing a topic is not to introduce it directly, but introduce it very whimsically and cryptically. So if a student was asked, what's 9 + 3? Okay, they can count in their head and they go, it's 12. But I would ask a student, I want you to show me 9 + 3 using your fingers. Just show me how you... So of course they'd put up, they'd count to 9, and then they'd probably go 10, and then they would close both hands and go 11, 12, and I go, stop. Now, if I just took a picture of this, people would think that they've counted 2. But they've actually counted 12, so this would be my way of introducing modular mathematics, because it's mod 10. So what I've learned through time, I wasn't like this as a first-year teacher. Are you kidding me? And I would never want to be that teacher to begin. Like, a lot of people think, okay, I wish I'd been this thing. That's life. That's what age and wisdom does. I don't want to have age and wisdom at 19. I want to be a foolish teenager, making a whole bunch of foolish mistakes. That's life. So the idea of that organic piece is just how you would talk about anything to a human being, like through curiosity, through that lens of curiosity. Because I for one find it very difficult how people cannot be curious in general, but even mathematics. Like, we've gotten to that stage where you're talking about anxiety, and in the book I talk about Peter Taylor, who was Peter Harrison's mentor, who's still teaching at Queen's University here, about 2.5 hours from where I live. He said alienation occurs before anxiety, that kids become disassociated with mathematics early on, and the anxiety builds in when mathematics becomes more complicated, because they'd stop paying attention. The stakes weren't high when they were early on, and they just, this mathematics isn't for me, stop paying attention to it. And alienation is the precursor to anxiety. In fact, if I could use a medical term, anxiety is the metastasis of alienation. It's the undiagnosed math issue. And again, alienation is related to elementary, and alienation is because there was no romance. Mm-hmm. And now they feel guilty that they're not good at mathematics. Why don't I like mathematics? They feel it's 100% their fault. And that's one extra psychological, social, emotional thing that these children have to take on, which is so not true. And how much dysfunction that does to one's self-esteem and just other things too. It just gets more, it's really a tough thing to really overcome, because anxiety leads to trauma. You know, imagine not being able to do mathematics or struggling with it and being in a math classroom every day. And then being judged and assessed and having numbers of scores and tests coming at you and fail and all that. I think that's traumatic. And so the Shakespearean tragedy irony of this is that mathematics is the exact opposite. And that, you know, that's why I said it actually can create this place of wellness where you just kind of, you know, moon over mathematics just randomly. And I mean, everything about mathematics, every day I'm learning something new about mathematics. I'll probably learn something new tonight. I'll just Google something about a number or a pattern or something. I don't know. But I still do that.
I'm going to bring in a bit of Paul Lockhart. I'm a huge fan of his books as well, A Mathematician's Lament. And I think in it he almost says, like, doesn't even believe in mass anxiety. If you present mathematics in its rawest, most natural state to children, and, you know, he gives the example of, you don't expect children to be perfect, 100% perfect at language for them to write poetry and stories. They can do that, you know, we encourage them at a young age, but we somehow don't encourage them to get things wrong and play with maths and get things as wrong as possible and then converge into something or find other pathways and so on.
It's nice that you brought up Paul Lockhart and that specific example with writing, because I told my own daughter, who's a really good writer, the biggest piece of advice I can give you about writing, Rhea, don't worry about the grammar. Just write. Don't worry about periods and commas and just write, get your flow going. Right? Of course, because the precision will come later. But what is she at? But precision was asked of her early on. Like, you know, a proper grammatical structure and sentence and things like that. I don't know. That would probably kill my interest in writing. Right. So the answer is strangely simple. I don't know if our system, and, you know, the fact that we have a pedagogical heavyweight, Alfred North Whitehead, who was not only, you know, he wrote The Aims of Education, but he also co-wrote Principia Mathematica with Bertrand Russell in 1910, 1913, and that book is number 23 in modern libraries, top 100 nonfiction books of all time. And it's like, there's a joke that only 6 people have actually read it, because it's all sort of modern symbolic logic. Everything is sort of deduced from, like, scratch, like, you know, 1 + 1 = 2. So he's a mathematical heavyweight, and he said some pretty powerful things about learning in general. And the one which really, again, it's all true. Inert knowledge is not only not beneficial, it's also harmful. And what he meant by that is that if you give kids too much inert knowledge in which there's no application for it outside of it, just its own knowledge, is that the kids will actually have a disdain for knowledge without actually possessing any knowledge. So it's all for naught. Education and mathematics, it's all for naught. So you can have all the guidelines, you can have all the expectations and all the benchmarks, all these things met, but it's transient, because the kids will forget mathematics. Why do you have review in mathematics in September? Isn't the definition of learning that you don't forget it? Well, because they never learned it. Like, that's the running joke. That, you know, I I know how to tie my shoelaces. I know how to cook. I know how to ride a bike. I know how to drive a car, because I've learned these things through practice. And, you know, and, well, the mathematics hasn't been learned if they forget everything, right? So it's all for naught. By the time they exit, like, I mean, how many people, if I wasn't interested in math education or a mathematics teacher, how much math, and Paul Lockhart talks about this too, how much mathematics would I have remembered? You know, as he said, kids have vague memories of quadratic formulas, but they have clear memories of hating them. That's the reality. And we don't address that elephant in the room too well, because we're still doing the same things, kind of. So unless a lot of these ideas that we've been talking about can make in the classroom organic conversations, organic teaching, real life problem solving in front of your students, failing in front of your students, not failing to show them, hey, you know what? Because failure has been the predominant theme of mathematics for its entire history. What do we do in school? What do we expect in school? Pass success. So good luck squaring that circle.
It made me think a lot then about, it's making me reflect in different ways and thinking, okay, well, when it comes to music, we wouldn't expect somebody who's composing a piece to suddenly, you know, Beethoven didn't write any of his symphonies absolutely perfectly first time round. He wasn't able to just recite it onto a page. Well, he can't recite it because it hadn't been, he hadn't yet composed it, but it would have gone through a tremendous amount of work and processes and different layers, pop songs, anything like that. You know, when it comes to music, it's allowed. You're allowed to pick up your instrument. You're allowed to squeak when you're playing your saxophone accidentally. You're allowed to practice how you, the order in which you play the keys on a piano, or all of these things are allowed. I think there, you mentioned earlier as well, Dave, as well, didn't you, about sport? It's allowed. It's in rock climbing. People will, I see it because my children rock climb. Other people in the room will make suggestions when they come back down. Oh, well, that didn't quite work. Have you tried this hold here instead? And they go, oh, great idea. Let me have another go. It's never seen as a failure or a negative. And it's trying just change that narrative, isn't it? As you say, to put that fun, that romance back into it. Yes, precision matters when it comes to your toolbox and you're practicing all these things, and you want to put all of those layers in there because you want that thirst for knowledge, and you want to be able to go back and tackle that problem or be able to access something new. But we've got to be able to fail a lot.
Fail in also... Failure and creativity are linked together, because in the book I talk about one of the problems in that 1,000-hour exam, where you had to find the side of the square and you had 3 points, 3, 4, 5 units away from the 3 of the 4 vertices, point P, and with that minimal information, find the side of the square. And one of the solutions was absolutely brilliant, was the rotation of a triangle outside, and then that was the first move, and then there's still about so much work to do left, which is high school trigonometry, but that was anticlimactic, because for me, everything was about that first move, was about that clever insight. And I've been like that with mathematics myself. Like, I like trig identities, and I like challenging ones, but I don't finish them, because once I understand, I've found that whether it's getting a common denominator, whether it's a factoring a negative sign or something tricky, and then I realize, oh, okay, it looks like I'm going to get the answer, I stop. And which goes back to something very important about mathematics, which is related to play, which I talked about in my second book, Math Recess. If you look at the actual psychological definition of play, and there's like all these bullet points about what makes play pure play, is that play is voluntary. So voluntary also not only to come into to play, but also voluntary to leave. And we have this stigma that if there's a problem, you should finish it. Do you have any problems I never finished? Like, it wasn't like, like, I didn't feel like any slight, like, okay, I go, hey, there's one problem I just won't do or can't do. I put my own time into it that I felt was valuable. And did I, should I sit there for like X number of hours or days just to prove a point that I got it right? No. And, but all the power to the people who cracked this one. I'm not feeling like, you know, less of myself. I'm completely happy with what I did. And I think that's another thing about me in mathematics is that I am free to come and go.
Good. Lovely comment on YouTube. As Brian Eno says, art is how we embrace uncertainty.
That's there you go. I love that quote. Art is how... Oh, I love that quote. I'm going to... It's on Twitter, right? So I will definitely capture it and retweet that.
And yeah, I mean, you mentioned very early on. I mean, I was making some notes while you're talking, and we could go on all sorts of tangents. But I've made some notes. But mentioned, yeah, like just from a practical point of view, just the very history of mathematics, the story, the narrative is absolutely fascinating. And I'd always like to go back to the original source. You know, I looked up the book Liber Abaci, for example, and I'm just scanning. It's available digitally, and all books. Like people talk, for example, people talk about the theory of evolution, but very few people have actually read the original book by Darwin. I've got it in my Kindle, and it's great to have this. Like, you know, I think Paul Lockhart calls that thematic history. So that's like the numbers have a very fascinating thematic history. Yeah, I say something
and,
like,
and you know, what's lost in that story too is that you have, you know, Leonardo of Pisa, 13 at a time. Fibonacci was a name given to him later on. Is that he's tagging along with his father on a business trip to Bougia, northern port in Algeria. So he happens to be at the right place at the right time, because all the stuff coming up the Silk Road was not just, you know, goods, but also intellectual knowledge, which had gone through the House of Wisdom in Baghdad, you know, which is sort of equivalent to the House of Alexandria. And all this intellectual knowledge which had come, and that knowledge had come from India and China and the mathematics. And you got this 13-year-old teenager being in the right place at the right time. And what kids, well, even teachers, I guess, fail to understand is every piece of mathematics was at one point not understood. So questions like ratio proportion, which we take for granted, At that time, merchants and tradespeople couldn't do that problem. They would take that problem to a special cleric or whatever, and they'd be responsible for making the calculations. And you've had, you know, Leonardo Pisa, basically through the arithmetic that he came across, found all these ways where now, that's why this book became so popular, is that anybody could do it. And they would show you how. And algebra, you know, we always talk about, okay, well, algebra, who needs algebra and all that, you know, it was born out of practicality. It was born out of, you know, situations of inheritance, of commerce, trade. That's where, if you look at the original problems from Al-Khwarizmi, it's all based on that. And then again, we think algebra is like with symbols. That came later with Descartes. But algebraic thinking and algebraic problem solving, algebraic ideas, we didn't have the symbology yet. They were like long texts, but the algebraic thinking of what to do to isolate for the unknown in question, that was the algebra. And if you don't tell any of these stories, then most kids will think that mathematics was dropped off by aliens in a test tube on a beach 100 years ago. Why else would... Well, ask kids where math comes from. I bet you half the kids it comes from a textbook. Like if you're teaching mathematics and half the kids think that mathematics is not a human construct and not a human construct of every race, civilization, culture, hunter, gatherer, tribe, then you've wasted a lot of time. That's the first thing that should be acknowledged and acknowledged throughout, is that this is and has been a historical journey by everybody who's ever existed. Like it is truly the universal language, and every culture, like I said, has had contributions and has been equally fascinated by mathematics.
Fantastic.
Yeah, wow. It makes me think back to what Mary Myatt was saying and says about learning through stories and how that really, really helps to convey message and meaning. And as you were just saying there, Sunil, and you started the conversation with that thread at all. It's maths is this huge story with all of these complex intertwined threads. It's not just something that's been printed in a book. There's so much history behind it. It's difficult to know where to start, I think, with sharing it, so you don't get too distracted from the maths. But I think I don't know enough about the history and where it comes from. You know, I'm pretty good at the processes. That layer is important, that I read up on it more and I'm able to convey at least a small amount of that.
And, you know, one of the things, and just in terms of the minutes that we have, Dan Finkel's TED Talk, Five Extraordinary Practices of Mathematical Teaching, which I think is the number one TED Talk now. And Dan, he wrote the foreword of my second book. The third practice, the third bullet point of the five extraordinary practices: your job is not to be the answer key. Now, that's a bit dislodging for a lot of math teachers saying, well, what do you mean my job is not the answer key? Don't we want our teachers to be proficient and all that? I would say yes. I also say no simultaneously. I'm more interested in the teacher who's interested in finding the answer than the teacher who possesses it. And I'll put my money where my mouth is. And I use this story as an example sometimes. Let's say my son, they're now older, but my daughter, let's say, was going to have a third grade teacher, and she had a choice of two teachers, one who had a mathematics background, university degree, a little bit of old school, well-intentioned, but was really, you know, kind of strict and not precision, but definitely had a math background. Another teacher was her first year teaching, and she came from a humanities to arts background, which meant it was her first year teaching third grade mathematics. But if she went to my daughter in my daughter's class and said, you know, this is my first year teaching, which means my first year teaching third grade mathematics, how about we learn third grade mathematics together? Every single lifetime, my daughter's going in that class. Every single time. I don't care how many mistakes this teacher makes, but I know in the long run, that whole disarming quality and sort of care and idea of wanting human relationships to be at least side by side with the learning, that's where I want my kids to be. So this is all accessible. We just have to let go of certain things. Like literally, like lighten our weight. Like we're so like we must have bad postures metaphorically because of how much weight we carry of our expectations as teachers and educators. Just have to let go of a lot of things, because that's not how mathematics was explored or enjoyed, right?
Oh wow, thank you.
Yeah.
At risk here of just sitting and listening all evening and then forgetting to get involved and the other aspects of what we're doing as well. So I think it would be quite nice to start bringing in some people's takeaways as well and seeing how that rounds off the session and the direction of travel for these for this last bit. I'm sorry, I'm just absolutely you can see I'm deep in thought here. Dave, would you like to start, and then maybe we'll come round to you as well, Athol, if that's okay, for some ways to round off the session. It's just covered so much ground. Over to you, Dave.
Oh, thank you. And yeah, well, I mean, massive compliment in me saying that the second half of that session, I don't think I've been quieter, as I was just sort of absorbing. And there were these silences where usually I'd come in and I'd sort of think about how I could manage the room, what questions could I ask, and I was just like, oh no, I just want to listen. I just want to listen to this next bit. So it's been wonderful. A few of my takeaways that I've just been jotting down notes. You've probably seen me with head down at times here. The first stage is romance. The idea that precision is important, but we don't rush to precision. I think those are really sticking in my mind. You don't have to be good at something to like it. I thought about why I went into maths teaching, and it was that idea of what would I be good at was what was driving my decisions. I'm not saying for a second I'm a good maths teacher, but it was driving my decisions as to where I wanted to go, and I was really lucky that I found my passion, I think. But
well, I'll just quickly interrupt you because I have a quote. Even though I've written three books, there's two things I've written which I go, Sunil, that was actually a good quote. So regarding the don't have to like it, what I wrote was, if your love of mathematics ever gets eclipsed by your ability of mathematics, so if your love of mathematics is ever eclipsed by your ability, then both will be doomed.
I love that quote. That's brilliant. And I need to write that down. I might listen. I'm going to have to listen to this back again, aren't I, and get those. It's awesome. And another thing that stood out for me was around that. The anxiety and alienation comes before anxiety, and sort of thinking about just supporting my students in my classes to feel a little bit more curious every day, and how what I think I was focused at the beginning of this session on what can we do to reduce or mitigate the mass anxiety, and now for me I have a different mindset about that, and that session has really helped me to frame that we're just going to look at the curiosity, and we're going to think about how we support our students to be a little bit more curious each day. That was important for me, and the idea of patience being a habit, and that's a harder thing to develop than sort of your mathematical maturity, I think you said, but that really stuck with me as well.
So just to interrupt you again, right, so here's my second quote. I've got there's two quotes that I'll have for my life. The second one is, patience is not your ability to wait; it's your attitude while you wait.
Oh, it's lovely. Yes, I mean, this is just saying it so more articulate than I go through these points. I love that so much. And it was just the idea that a failure and creativity being linked together. There's something that
I like. I love that. I like that one a lot, Brian Eno. That was a good quote. I love that.
So good. Oh, what's the session? This has been Sunil. Thank you so much for your time. I'll hand over to Athol and Reed to sort of share their takeaways also. But yeah, as you can see, I've got so much of that. That's just the sort of surface of what I'm taking away tonight.
Thanks, Dave. That's an incredible a summary and takeaway. There's a few comments coming in from I'll just acknowledge some people who are out there on social media. Shivanand, who's a teacher in India, who's in Delhi, who's up at 1 o'clock listening to it.
Wow.
for the love of mathematics, so he's on Twitter, so thank you for doing that. I've got D on Facebook, and Kem's been also commenting. Thanks for your ideas, Kem, especially on getting Colin Foster and Frank Com on math syllabus based on storytelling. There's loads of good things in there as well. So something for me to follow up. But really, yeah, I mean, probably not much more to add there from what you've already, a very succinct summary. The only things that I suppose that sort of appeal to me is the history side of mathematics. It's naturally so beautiful and so rich that it doesn't need to be made fun or interesting. It is already fun and interesting. You just look it up. If there is one thing I want any teacher or tutor, whoever teaches maths, takeaways, like one of the things that I said right at the beginning was that you must show your vulnerability at slogging through a maths problem, because that's actually what mathematicians do. I like to show this video to my students. I think it's called Beauty is Suffering, Part 1 is a mathematician, and it shows Andrew Wiles. Is very, very emotional, passionate story on working this on Fermat's last problem, and you know that there hasn't been around a solution for hundreds of years, and he's still working at it, and he forgets to eat, and his wife's calling him up, and he says, "I figured it out," and wife thinks something like he's found a solution to something else, or like a problem at home, but it's actually the Fermat's last theorem one, and. I'm in a fortunate position. I do one-on-one tutoring, and I've got a further maths student, and I'm having to relearn it. But I'm relearning. I was very honest with him. I've been teaching him for 3-4 years, and I said, "Well, you know, I've forgotten this stuff, but I kind of need you to just hit me. I literally tell, just hit me with that question. Of course, he can email me and tell me what he's stuck at. But I said, I just want you to hit me live with that question, and I will show you how." I'll wriggle my way out of it, or maybe I can't. And then sometime I'm over at Wolfram Alpha finding the answer first and kind of reverse engineering it. But I think all of this stuff is so important. Yeah.
And I think I failed to mention this, I know, but it's also important, which humanizes mathematics. And I did tweet this out a while back, is that I have various emotions about mathematics. I love mathematics. There's like lots of things I love about it. There's parts I like mathematics, like it's okay. There's parts I dislike, and there's parts I hate. Like, it's like food. Like, how can you like every kind of food? Do you have your preferences? So we as teachers, we don't present mathematics the most human way, that like everything about mathematics is, like, for example, like, you know, even though I mentioned trig proofs, I mean, especially when you have to draw the trig functions by hand and phase shifts and things like that, and or just the transformations of exponential functions. I just don't care. I don't care. I that's me. Somebody else might, but I don't. And when you show that honesty or whatever, and I go, look, can we just get through this, please, please, please? Then they're going to believe you when something you're really excited about. And we always, it's like. We create this really long mid-range of everything is wonderful, and then we also don't talk about other parts of ourselves that's like, you know, like I like mathematics as much as I just said other things, and you would see that same emotion. So when you actually bring mathematics down into the regular stream of life's consciousness, everything else, that's when you elevate it. When you elevate it all the time, it's tiring, and it's actually going to, like, kids are not going to believe you. Like, okay, I don't think math is as great as you think it is. But when you humanize it, it actually will elevate by itself. The story tells itself.
Wow. I don't quite know how to follow up on all of that, guys. You've covered so much this evening. And so mine are just things like, I suppose, key words for me now. It's reminding myself about curiosity and romance and intrigue, and also I think to be genuine and authentic. So instead of now going away and trying to find out all these amazing things about mathematics and sharing them all because they're all amazing, it's okay, let's just remind myself of the one or two things that I truly find amazing and am intrigued by, and be genuine about that rather than contriving something, because kids will see right through it.
Oh.
And so seeing a genuine sort of that geeky curiosity of knowing something in an immense detail, I imagine is just going to be so much more interesting for people I'm talking to, because the passion you exude when you do something like that is so much more intense and real. I mean, I was just thinking tonight about, if you talk to Catherine at arithmetics, about, I think it's Pythagoras, She's hugely passionate about Pythagoras. So, you know, and it doesn't, she'll know lots, an immense amount of other things as well. But that is one thing that I know she said before now, that she can talk at great length about and loves the details in the history. So
Pythagoras.
I think that would be, for me, I'm just going to dig a bit deeper and find that bit, that romance again, to help with that genuine curiosity rather than being the air hostess. Everything's amazing. So thank you so much for this evening. It is just absolutely incredible. Struggling to string sentences together, I think, because my brain is just linking so many different things up, and I really, really, really appreciate it. And being able to pick up your book and find my own enjoyment out of it as well, not studying it, but enjoying getting involved with it. And I just wanted to say a huge thank you for that, and for your time and everything you've shared with us all.
And you know, just as Joe Bowler wrote in the foreword, which I think is really, I mean, it's a wonderful foreword, but she just said it right in her first paragraph, like, what is your story? Like, that's really what the book is about, is finding your voice, your story, finding opportunities to share it. And as sort of Dave said, you know, maybe just sort of creating a, not a different personality, but just something, you know. That's the other thing, too, is that in my days of teaching, we only have one voice. So how I was in the classroom was how I was outside the classroom, was how I am in the home. And I would tell the students the same thing. Like, I don't want to see a fake personality in here. I don't want to be outside, I catch you in the hallway and I get this, you're laughing and you've got a different personality. I don't want to hear about high school drama or any F-bombs or things like that. But if learning is going to stick with you, I need to see yourself. Well, if you're going to show yourself, which means I have to create a safe and disarming environment. So, I mean, there's a lot of other things which we have to have in place for the mathematics to take hold, but they become intertwined eventually, and it just becomes effortless.
Thank you. I think that's a brilliant note for us this evening. You've been incredible, Sunil. Thank you so much.
This has been wonderful. And like I said, you know, I would love to, you know, come back on anytime, maybe a year from now. You know, you know, because I mean, the book, it's been out, but I mean, it's, you know, we'll see where we are, what has been adopted, what has sort of changed in the math education landscape, all these things. I mean, you know, even digging specifically into certain ideas of the book, because, you know, we kind of, we're all around it, and there was some good referencing, but yeah, I'd love to come on again, and it'd be wonderful to see where we are in 2023.
That would be brilliant. Thank you. Thank you so much, Atul. Thank you, Dave.
Thank you, Atul. Thank you, everyone. Thank you, Dave.
Absolutely. My absolute pleasure, and you're very welcome to come back. And that's one of my visions behind, I mean, I was an online tutoring geek teaching students all over the world before the pandemic. And for me, the I realized I could use these skill sets in hosting things like this, and just the power of getting you from the States live in Bristol, Dave, and the Wales border, and myself in London. The things we can now accomplish is phenomenal, and I'm in awe of the company now I can have with you all. And I run Math Chat Live for selfish reasons, basically to be in your company and people I really admire and respect, and people I may not know, and then become friends. So yeah, what's a huge round of thank you again. There'll be a recording of this. It's a live stream, so people can watch it. I'll put an audio one as well, and I'll give you the book club as well, an audio recording that you can use. And so it's all out there. And the conversation, that never really ends, because we have this on YouTube and Twitter. So if you have a question that's come up later, you're watching this on a replay, put a question, we'll do our best to answer. So brilliant. I'll end the stream now, and then we'll stay on the Zoom call for a little bit, just the four of us, and then we can have a quick debrief and finish. So I'll thank you, everyone, and I'll stop the stream button now, just do a quick wave.